is Flo Joseph and Harold Kimball interviewing Alvin Rosensweet at his home on Maple Heights Court in Pittsburgh on October 9, 1986. We're going to ask him a few questions in just a moment.
He wanted to continue.
Now, Alvin, you want to continue talking about your move to Pittsburgh, or better still, something you want to tell us about that happened in Dayton, Ohio.
I'd like to talk about a couple of things in Dayton, Ohio. The 1940s were a period of intense labor activity after the formation of the CIO. United Electrical Union had organized Univis, capital U-N-I-V-I-S, Univis Lens Company in Dayton, a manufacturer of optical lenses. There was a strike at this company, which was really small in comparison to the large corporations, but it was very intense. For several days, almost the entire Dayton Police Department was brought out to the Univis Lens plant. One day, the governor had ordered the National Guard into Dayton, and I was covering this strike, and suddenly I saw strikers to one side of me armed with sticks, baseball bats, bricks, and rocks, and approaching them from the opposite side across a vacant lot was a National Guard with their rifles fixed. I was right in the middle of this thing, and I decided to get out of there. There was a building adjacent to the lot. I found a steel ladder, scampered up it onto the roof, and observed the action from the rooftop. Later, of course, we found out that the National Guard had been ordered not to load their rifles. During this period, I was once thrown down a flight of steps by a labor leader in Dayton, and there were some very hectic times. I do want to mention briefly that while I was writing sports, I covered the Grand American Handicap at Vandalia, Ohio, near Dayton, which is the world's largest trap shooting event, and subsequently wrote an article for Esquire magazine on the Grand American Handicap. During my time in Dayton, I was also able to interview a number of theatrical celebrities, including comedian Bob Hope, orchestra leader Ben Burney, and Gypsy Rose Lee, the stripper, who surprisingly was a very intelligent woman, and sent me an autographed copy of her book, Mother Finds a Body. One of the first things I did after moving to Pittsburgh was to be assigned by my publisher, Bill Block, to write in-depth stories on cities in the tri-state area around Pittsburgh. The first one I wrote was about McKeesport, and this took most of the 24-page section of a Sunday Post-Gazette magazine. I went into all aspects of society in McKeesport: labor, industry, society, politics, rackets, and it was really a very, very thorough job, one that newspapers often don't do. Later, I was assigned to do a similar story in Wheeling. I lived in Wheeling for 2 weeks, then went back with a photographer. I wrote 10,000 words on Wheeling, and the Post-Gazette Sunday edition, which had started in March 1949, died in November 1949, and my 10,000 words on Wheeling never got into print.
Why did it die? Why did the newspaper?
Well, there are several theories. I thought it was really an outstanding newspaper, But they had trouble with circulation, and there was intense competition. The Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph, when I came to Pittsburgh in 1949, claimed to be the only newspaper with 500,000 circulation. The Sun-Telly then had over 500,000 Sunday circulation, which has disappeared, and nobody knows where it went to.
Including the Pittsburgh Press?
No.
There was the Press?
The Sun-Telly alone had 500,000 circulation.
Did it have competition?
We had competition from the Sunday Press, which was a long-established Sunday newspaper.
Yeah, that's
so was
the
Sun-Telly.
It was just the Sunday that you're talking about that had died. Is that correct?
The Sunday edition of the Post-Gazette ended in November 1949. It lasted less than a year. We were told, a loss of several million dollars. I'd like to go through these notes. They won't be in chronological order.
That's all right.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Chicken Hill was an exciting experience. Some bank bandits robbed a bank and fled into the Chicken Hill section of the West End.
Of
Pittsburgh.
You mean there's a section
of Pittsburgh that most people don't know about.
It's
called Chicken Hill.
Where is it?
And there's also another section of Pittsburgh that nobody ever heard about. It's called Seldom Seen.
And I think that's... I was born here, never heard of it.
You never heard of Maple Heights Court.
You're so right.
But the police department went after these bandits, and the reporters were in the immediate area, and suddenly we heard gunshots, and we all had to get down behind police cars and to protect ourselves and to keep ourselves from getting possibly getting shot. A story that I am really proudest of is one about a black couple who tried to buy a home in Mount Lebanon. In the long story that I wrote about them, at their request, I didn't use their names. The story provoked a hearing by a state housing agency in Pittsburgh, and their names became public, so I can divulge them. Ken Hawthorne and his wife, Jean.
What year was that?
This was in 1965. The story was that when this couple sought to buy a house in Mount Lebanon, there was a conspiracy among realtors and neighbors and other people who were trying to keep them out of Mount Lebanon. Actually, they would not have bought the house that they were looking at because it wasn't big enough for them. Ironically, they later bought a house in Scott Township, later moved to Mount Lebanon, and when Ken became a vice president of Gulf Oil Corporation, he and his wife and their two sons moved to Houston. I won a Golden Quill for that story, but I must tell you the reaction was unbelievable. I had threatening and obscene phone calls. I had an obscene phone call, I'll never forget it, 4 o'clock in the morning. I had so many threatening phone calls that I called Dave Craig, who was then the public safety director, and within minutes there were about 6 police cars outside my house on Maple Heights Court, and they kept police on for 24 hours a day for a week until problem subsided. Another story that I was very proud of was about Betty Lou Gilliam. In the summer of 1955,
G-I-L-L-I-A-M,
Betty Jean Gilliam. In the summer of 1955, a man was driving a car down a steep hill, I believe it was Hazelwood Avenue in Hazelwood. He had a heart attack, lost control of his car. a group of school children were standing at the corner of 2nd Avenue and Hazelwood, and the car plowed into them. It killed one of the boys, John Minadeo, for whom the John Minadeo School near Squirrel Hill in Hazelwood is named. And Betty Jean Gilliam, a black girl, was seriously injured and was taken to Montefiore Hospital, where she lay in a coma for weeks. Her parents had to come to the hospital daily and spoon feed her. Friends of the family and some community leaders came to the Post-Gazette and told us that the doctor said that Betty Jean would have to stay in the hospital unless she had a better place to live. Her family then lived in, I'd only have to describe it as a dump, on 2nd Avenue near what was then the Jones and Laughlin Steel Mills. I wrote a number of stories, and we raised $15,000 to buy the Gilliams a new house, a house in Hazelwood, for, at that time, it seems incredible now, but the house was about $8,500. In addition to buying the house, a number of businessmen provided, I have a cousin in the paint and wallpaper business, he provided paint. He had the house painted and papered. Another company provided storm doors and screen doors, and we outfitted the house. Henry Smith, who was then a lawyer and has been a judge for many years, and Wendell Freeland, a Pittsburgh lawyer, served as executors of the estate. They handled the financial aspects, together with the Pittsburgh National Bank, and the family moved into the house, and they're there to this day. And at that time, Strike a Rich, which was a program on CBS, had one feature in which they honored a newspaper person who had done some kind of good deed, and they called me, and I went to New York and appeared on Strike It Rich.
Strike It Rich,
1955. Strike It Rich. Strike It Rich.
I used to watch it.
Yes.
It was produced by Walt Framer, a former Pittsburgher.
Yeah. What year did we establish what year that all took place?
That was 1955.
1955.
The
30 years.
The civil rights disturbances in the late 60s and the early 1970s were also a period of great activity. I covered most of the civil rights disturbances for the Post-Gazette, and I had a number of interesting experiences. The blacks and militant whites throughout at least the eastern part of the country and the Middle West had organized what they called Resurrection City in Washington, where they set up tents and poor people were taken there on buses to protest racial discrimination. Groups had come in from all over the Midwest to Pittsburgh. They had come from Milwaukee, led by a Father Gropey, who was an activist, a white Catholic priest. They had come in from Cleveland and Chicago. They stayed overnight in Pittsburgh. They had a big rally at the Civic Arena, and the next night they were going by bus on to Washington. I was to go to Washington with them, and I took a suitcase, went down to the Civic Arena, and there was a lot of milling around, and suddenly I realized I was being surrounded by a group of militants, blacks and whites, and there was one woman chanting what I later found out were some kind of an African voodoo curse on me. And they were closing in on me when suddenly Matthew Moore, who was a leader of the NAACP, broke through the mob, grabbed me by the hand and just pulled me away. I think he may not have saved my life, but I think he saved me from injury. Later, I talked to the police lieutenant who was in charge of a detail. They were standing right across the street up at the Civic Arena, and he told me that they were, at the time that Matthew had pulled me away, they were just about ready to move in on this mob to rescue me. This is a small incident, but it was typical of what was going on at the time. I was in the Hill District, the black area of Pittsburgh, taking notes in a notebook when a young black boy just ran up to me and grabbed my notebook away and said, "I'm going to read your notes to see what you're writing about us." That was the first time that had ever happened to me. As a part of that that civil rights movement, I'm sure you'll remember that in 1970, four students were killed at Kent State University. I didn't go up there. I don't think the Post-Gazette sent anybody up there. We depended on the wire services to cover it. But when the names came across the wire, one of the students who was killed was Allison Krause, capital K-R-A-U-S-E, of Churchill. I went out with the photographer to see her parents. In the newspaper business, I don't think there's anything worse than being assigned to go out to talk to the family of someone who has been killed or something terrible has happened to them. I went out and talked to Arthur Krause and his wife. They were as nice as they could be. They gave us a lovely picture of their daughter. But what I remember most about that, we got there just about the time they were leaving, I think, for Ravenna, Ohio, where the bodies of the dead students had been taken. And as I said goodbye to Mrs. Krause, she cried out, makes me cry to this day, "My baby." She just cried out, "My baby." It was a very, very sad, sad event. I'm going to come back to these. I was in the office on November 22nd, 1963, when we got word that President Kennedy had been assassinated in Dallas, Texas. I was assigned to do a local story on it, and I went out of the office. I went right across the street from the Post-Gazette to St. Mary's Church, and people were streaming out and sobbing. They hadn't heard of it and had been to a prayer service. I talked to people on the street, and of course, the whole country was bereaved, and the front page of the Post-Gazette on which that story appeared is hanging in the Pittsburgh Press Club. Out of my background of writing sports, I was assigned to do color stories on the World Series in 1960 between the Pirates and the New York Yankees. And in the seventh game of the World Series, which was won by the Pirates on Bill Mazeroski's home run, I wrote this story, which appeared on page one of the Post-Gazette, and that page also has been preserved at the Pittsburgh Press Club. I can say with some levity that the Post-Gazette, like other newspapers, puts out some items for sale, and among them are Post-Gazette umbrellas, and page one of the 1960 World Series is on the umbrella, and I've been immortalized on an umbrella.
You have.
That's a major
claim to fame.
Claim to fame.
And
I've been
rightfully
immortalized on an umbrella. On an umbrella.
Beautiful. What a story.
Yeah. I had covered the primary campaigns of John F. Kennedy, yet the president in 1960, and Hubert Humphrey, the senator from Minnesota. They were campaigning in West Virginia during the 1960 primary campaign, which of course was won by Kennedy. And I also was assigned to go to Wheeling during, I guess it was the, could have been the 1952 campaign won by Eisenhower. Richard Nixon, who later became president and the disgraced president of the United States, had made his famous Checkers speech in which he defended a fundraising scheme, and he had referred to Checkers, his dog. And I went to Wheeling, where Eisenhower was to speak, and Nixon flew in to meet Nixon, and they conferred about that incident.
And you covered it?
I covered that meeting between Eisenhower and Nixon.
How did they seem to get along?
Eisenhower supported Nixon, and there was a feeling at the time that he might want to get kick Nixon off the ticket as his vice presidential candidate, to dump him, but he didn't and kept him on.
I wish you'd have dumped him. I'm not allowed to say that.
During 1950, I think it was 1957, I was assigned to do profiles on business leaders in Pittsburgh, the president of Westinghouse, Mellon National Bank, and some other large companies here, and these ran as full-page articles in the Post-Gazette. A story that really fascinated me was one about a Pittsburgher. I don't even want to use his name because he was sort of a greasy character, and I think his family still lives here. He posed or claimed to be an undercover agent for the FBI, and he had apparently and falsely accused several Pittsburghers of being communists. And he was later disproved. I think I helped to disprove him in a series of articles, and my publisher thought so highly of those articles that he nominated me for a Pulitzer Prize, which unfortunately I didn't win. Another story, very late in... I said it was near the twilight of a mediocre career, was on the death of Wen Chin Chin, a Taiwanese who was a professor of statistics at Carnegie Mellon University.
W-E-N-C-H-E-N.
Wen Chin Chin, capital W-E-N. C-H-E-N, Wen Chin Chin.
That made national news.
That made national news, and I want to interject here that I was a stringer here for the New York Times for 20 years, and I in addition to writing stories on Wen Chin Chin for the Post Gazette, I wrote several long stories for the New York Times on the subject.
Is there anything
He was a professor who was opposed to the Kuomintang, the ruling party in Taiwan. He had gone to Taiwan with his wife, Su Jin, and he was found dead on the grounds of a university campus The government claimed that he had either fallen accidentally from the building or had jumped, but other people felt that he had been murdered because of his opposition to the government.
Was he murdered in
Taiwan?
And he was murdered in Taiwan, and later his father came to the United States and was campaigning against the ruling government in Taiwan, and came to Pittsburgh, came to the Post-Gazette where I interviewed him, and he gave me a little trinket. And a book had been published in Taiwan about this whole subject, and I have it somewhere upstairs among my books, and it referred to me in a number of places. I got calls from on that story from a number of newspapers throughout the country, including a couple Chinese newspapers that are published in New York.
Well, what was the real dope? Isn't that what everybody wanted?
It has never been resolved. It has never been resolved. There was never a trial, and to this day, it's a mystery as to whether he was murdered or whether he fell to his death accidentally.
Do you know if the same government is in power today?
Oh yes, sure. The same government is in power. There was another incident in which a journalist was killed in San Francisco, and they traced it to high-level military people in the Taiwanese government, and some of them were kicked out of office and imprisoned. But there was never a resolution to the Wen Chin-Chin incident. I'm getting near the end.
Yes, that's the tape, so that's good.
Just the half
hour. During the latter part of my time at the Post-Gazette, I like to deal in language and in words, and I started to write a column on language, which I've kept up after my retirement. It runs on the opposite editorial page of the Post-Gazette periodically. It started off when I read a story in the Pittsburgh Press. The Mesta Machine Company was being reorganized, and a reporter asked the chairman how the reorganization plan was going, and his reply was something like, we're rounding third base and sliding into home plate. And I thought that was a strange use of the English language. They found a number of other examples similar to that. I started this column, and strangely enough, I received almost more response to that than anything that I ever read, except the story about the black couple that tried to buy the house in Mount Lebanon. I think we must have received several hundred letters. I had an interesting interview with Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, when he spoke to the Duquesne University Law School commencement. I think that was 1984, and a photographer took a picture of O'Neill and me, which I have in my office, and I cherish it very much, together with the only other picture that I thought enough of to hang up, and that was with President Truman on a train going from Indianapolis to Dayton in 1948, a year when I covered the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Can I pause?
Yeah. I think we should let this run out. There's about a second or two on it.
Mr. Riggins would catch his breath.
Yeah.
And turn it over. You're doing really
well. I was...
that's what being a reporter...
I was a... as I said, I was a stringer in Pittsburgh from 1965 until I retired in 1986. When I retired, I had two very lovely notes from Dave Jones, the national editor of the New York Times, and Seymour Topping, the managing editor of the Times, in appreciation of my work.
What exactly do you mean, Stringer?
A Stringer is a correspondent in a city other than New York who covers news of that city and area for the New York Times, but is not a full-time employee. They make that very clear. You're not a full-time employee of the Post-Gazette.
Okay, people might like to know.
That was very good, because not everyone knows what Stringer means.
I want to say, I think I've said enough about what I've done. And I just want to say that at this time, I have a son, Tom, who lives in New Jersey, has a master's in government from Cornell, and his undergraduate degree from Brandeis. My older son, Jim, lives in Lake Havasu, capital H-A-V-A-S-U, Arizona, is with his wife, Lois, and they have four children, so we're the grandparents of four children ranging from 12 years on down. I want to mention I made two trips to Israel. I want to make clear that I was not precisely assigned by the Post-Gazette. These were trips that were sponsored by the Israeli government at that time, and I took one trip in, I think, 1968, another in, I believe,